Thank you, ladies. At the end of the first missionary journey of the Apostle Paul, he came back at the end of chapter 14, Acts 13 and 14. He came back to the church at Antioch, and it says at the end of chapter 14 that he rehearsed with the church after he gathered them together the things that the Lord had done through them and how he'd opened up the door of faith to the Gentiles. I thought it was an interesting way of reading that, just reading it through as you read the Bible through. And maybe you're like I am. Sometimes you'll read through passages of the Scripture, and then all of a sudden life experience hits you. And when life experience hits you, now you read the Bible a little bit differently. That passage comes alive, or that passage has a little different slant to it than it did before. Well, I must say to you that this passage has a different slant to me today than even it did 2 weeks ago, because it's my joy to share with you what has been taking place in ministry over the past several weeks. And I'm going to do that in a two-part series, both this morning and tonight. I just have this day to invest with you. So I want to give you part A this morning, and I want to give you part B this evening, and to sort of give you an idea of what has been taking place over the past couple of weeks. It has been my joy over the past weeks to be in a very small room that would be about half the size of this platform if you were to cut it all the way to the wall and go that direction. And in that room, without air conditioning and with a fan, was crammed 27 men who are Chinese pastors to, through a translator, teach the book of Revelation through a translator. It was quite an experience. When Angela had talked with the leadership there, I was going to send them about a 20-25 page outline, and in correspondence with them, they requested that I would send a more in-depth outline because they don't have a lot of materials and they want to take these materials back with them. And so we put together about 100 pages of for the syllabus and then sent it to them. And then when I got there, they informed me that they were not able to translate it at all. It was too extensive for them, and for the limited amount of English that their translators had with such a difficult book, it will take them 1 year to do so. But they said, now you come back next year and we'll have it ready for the next class. So that's a blessing, but it was all of a sudden it postures you a little different, and you're thinking, man, I've got all this time, 30 hours, to teach these students, these pastors, the word, and so how do you do this? So it was a challenge from the very beginning, but I think the Lord was greatly honored by what took place. It was a joy for me to be. I flew in, and after doing a number of different things, Sunday was in a church and preached. They have four services, and I preached two of those services, and then Monday morning taught from the morning until the afternoon, about 4 o'clock. And then had a little break, had supper, and then in the evening, five, six, seven Chinese pastors would come to my apartment, and we would sit down with a translator, and then we would talk about ministry, and they would share testimonies, and we'd have questions going back and forth. So it was quite significant. Then they asked me if I'd preach Wednesday night, so I preached Wednesday night, and I thought, well, now I'll get a break. And I come back, and we have seven Chinese guys ready to come in after church Sunday night to talk, and so that's what happened Wednesday night, and then we went through the rest of the week, and it was a wonderful week, and had a great weekend at another location, preaching there morning and evening as well. So the Lord was very gracious, and I was happy to have the 22 hours to come back and to be here in the States, and I think that my body is beginning to catch up with all the other things that have taken place in my life over these past few weeks. I want to both this morning and tonight introduce you to some Chinese pastors. This morning, let me introduce you to six. All of them have an American name that begins with the letter N. The letter N, Neville. Neville was led to the Lord by his wife, and he now is a pastor. Niles. Niles was saved listening, came across the Far East Broadcasting Network, and was saved listening to Christian radio. Nathaniel had never heard the name of Jesus until he was 18 years old. He is now 42 years old and a preacher of the gospel. The The police have constantly harassed him, and in 2004, placed both he and his wife in jail. To increase his persecution, after 40 days, they let him out of prison, but they kept his wife in for the next year and a half. They thought that this would stop him. The police have him under constant surveillance, yet he continues to pastor a church in his house. Neil was led to the Lord by a pastor when he was only 12 years old. When he turned 24, he became a missionary to Tibet, has been a missionary there for 3 years, and then left there and did another 3 years in Hong Kong. He has come to study the Bible for a year at this undisclosed location, and he is going to return to southern China as a missionary of the gospel after he finishes his training. Norton was brought up in a godly home. Both his grandfather and his dad were pastors. Norton rebelled against the Lord, and his dad's house church had to discipline him out of the house church. This lasted for about a year. During this year, he said, the church loved me and prayed for me. Ultimately, his dad's sister loved him to Jesus, and he was gloriously saved, and now is the third generation of Chinese pastors in his family. Nathan is the first Christian in his family, unlike Norton. Nathan's family is a committed Buddhist family. But amazingly, God had them next door to a group of people whose teenage son was a believer in Jesus. This next door neighbor became his buddy. They began to live life together, and when he was 14, Nathan was led to the Lord by his fellow teen. In 1993, Nathan became an assistant pastor, and a few years later he was called to pastor a group of 20 countryside churches. He needed to understand the Bible, so for this year he's been studying at this undisclosed location, and he's going to return to China and continue pastoring these multiple churches. What do I learn from these six testimonies? And I will have six more for you tonight. One, I learned this, that people are saved in China like they are in America. Neville's wife led him to Christ. He's not a preacher. Niles was saved listening to Christian radio. He's not a preacher. Nathaniel was saved after having never heard the name of Jesus until he was 18 years old. Now he's a preacher. Neil was led to Christ by a pastor at an early age, now a missionary. Norton's aunt led him to Christ when he was a rebellious teenager. Now he's a third generation preacher. And Nathan's family is still today a devout Buddhist family. But his teenage friend had led him to Christ, and now he's a preacher. You see, nobody is saved without a witness. I was in Guam for my travels and had a wonderful time with some people from our church here, as well as some acquaintances from the past. One of the couples I was with late one night was, you remember Katie Bowers, now Brent and Katie. And it was a joy, and she said, please tell all the people, thank you for praying me through high school. Thank you for praying me through years in college. And God has given them a wonderful ministry, and they want to spend the rest of their lives there in, on that island, having ministry as they are now. And this year alone, both he and she have each led six people to Jesus Christ. How will they hear without a witness? It's the most amazing ministry that they're in, because 80% of the school that they teach in is unsaved, and there's 1,200 students, Korean and Chinese. And it's interesting to me how to hear their testimony as they shared with me. I feel like a whirlwind, but I land. They pick me up at the airport, and then we go right from there to a restaurant there. And at that restaurant, we were closing the place down late at night. It's amazing how the Lord just gives you energy, because I was just feeding off of what I am hearing God doing in the hearts of 24 and 25 year old kids. From my perspective, young people, where God is using, and how Brent plays with the Guam national basketball team. He's the basketball coach out there. And the opportunities he has to witness to people to Christ who we would never have an opportunity otherwise, and what the Lord is doing. I've learned by being away that people get saved the same way there as they do here. The second thing that I've learned is this, is that I think that there are two incredible needs in China today among the believers. I would say that the government acknowledges in China, the government acknowledges that there are 50 million Chinese in house churches. But when you talk with the pastors, they say that's a very conservative figure. We double that. There's probably 100 million in house churches. And these house churches are without theological education. These house church leaders, there are multiple. I could tell you of incidents through email that there are incredible things taking place in China, and there are no pastors of church after church after church. They meet together, they sing together, they talk about the scriptures together, but they are not taught the word. So the two incredible needs that we have are we need to ask the Lord for national pastors. And then secondly, we need to ask the Lord for their pastoral training because most are untrained. Most of the pastors in home churches are not, but they are facilitated by women. And there is a great struggle to follow the scriptures and how this all works together. So when I think of us and thinking sending Pastor Kirk over to another disclosed location so that that can happen with a year-long training of pastors, I would say to you, if there's ever been a need, now is the time. Now is the time. You see, there's an academic side, but there also what Pastor Kirk will bring is a pastoral side. There's an academic side where somebody like me will go in and will teach them a specific book, but then I'm gone. I'm away. So somebody has to be there as they are living there and off that dirt road, off the main road, and they are living there and they're 24/7, and who looks over their spiritual life? Who answers the questions now that we're away? So this is what Pastor Kirk's opportunity is to actually be there and facilitate a year-long training and do this year after year, bringing in people to teach. And then as those teachers leave, then now he has an opportunity to be able to provide pastoral leadership to these people. And to think of the multiplicity of the way that the gospel works. You invest your life in one. Many of these guys are pastoring, 12, 15, 20 house churches. There's no way they can do it in a day. But they start in the morning and they just work themselves to nighttime. And they are in church after church after church after church, or groups of people who are meeting together. It is the most amazing thing. And I think also, I wonder if we need to rethink our mission strategy. It takes literally thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to get missionaries over there, but the most effective means to reaching people is their own reaching their own. And so how do we think through that mission strategy? How do we train the nationals so that they can become effective pastors in their world? That is a burden that I have. I think the third thing I learned while I was away was this: the power of the printed page. And here's what I mean. In America, we have a problem, and that is this. If I were to say to you, let's look at a commentary on the book of Revelation, I could pull off of my shelf, 15 commentaries. I think I actually have 20 commentaries on my shelf, somewhere between 15 and 20 commentaries on my shelf that I could pull off. And as you watch the years go by, they become more massive and more massive and more technical and more technical, so that some of the most recent ones or most profound ones, most of the people here would not even enjoy reading. Commentaries are now being written for a very small group of people. And so what is needed is commentaries in understandable layman's language so that people can understand how the word flows. It is significant to me when I stood in front of this class and in here, I never told them my theological persuasion until near the end of my teaching, because we'd come up to an issue and I'd say, okay, now here's what one view has and here's what the other view has, and I'd give, now here's the strong point. They start to write it down, and I'd say, but, and then after a while it became sort of fun throughout the week. They would listen, but they knew but was coming. And I asked this question. I said, okay, let's look at your eschatological scheme. How many of you here hold to a pre-tribulational, pre-millennial view? Let me see your hands. And I was just overwhelmed that three-fourths of the men raised their hands, that this is their position. I say, how do you get here? How did you get there? Because you have no commentaries. Only one of the 27 had ever sat in a formal class to be taught the book of Revelation. Only one of all these pastors. And it was the two things that came back is kind of highlighted in, I have to give an exam at the end on Friday night. So I gave a 100-point exam. And in this exam, I was going to give them 10 points, 10% was going to give over, that if you could read the book of Revelation through two times from Monday until Friday at noon, because the exam's in the afternoon, evening, if you could, from the time I begin teaching, and of course they don't get back till 4 o'clock Monday afternoon, but if you could read the book through two times, that would be it. If you go one time over that, I will give you extra credit. So I come in on Friday, and on Friday, that's the very first question, how many times you read the book of Revelation through? And I start going through here 11 times, 9 times, 7 times, 5 times. I think one read it through twice. They are constantly given over to word saturation. That's all they have. They can't go to any other thing except the Word. And so they say, well, when I just read through the Scriptures, this is what it seems. It seems like the Lord is asking the church to prepare for His coming. And I said, wow, you guys can teach me an awful lot. And then the second thing I thought was really interesting was this. Somebody somewhere in the last two decades has translated the Scofield Reference Bible into Chinese. And this Bible has somehow made it from big cities to village churches. And they were very familiar with the Scofield Bible. So I'm here standing in front of these people. Now, some of them have never seen the Scofield Bible, but there were numbers who had. They'd heard of it. But here I am in front of these 27 men. 26 of them have not had any formal training in the book of Revelation, but they were seeing incredible tribulation around them, and they were getting chapters 2 and 3 because that's the majority of usages of the term philipsis, tribulation. Only one time is the word tribulation found after chapter 3 in the book of Revelation. And these people are experiencing the tribulation, the difficulty, the challenges. And they were comforted because John wrote in Revelation 1:9, I write to you as my brothers in tribulation and in kingdom and in endurance. And that ministered to them. John was in tribulation. We are going through tribulation. See, the problem with the American church is the only tribulation we have is not physical persecution. We're stressed because we don't have any time for ourselves or our family. And when you stop and consider this church, I just said the power of the printed page. How many of these guys said, do you think you could write this down? Could somebody translate this so we could have this? So all the way back, it was 22 hours. I'm flying and in airports and going back. I'm just writing on my legal size paper. And as I'm writing, I'm just saying, you know, Lord, wouldn't it be something if God, you would allow me to be able just to write a commentary for the church and just take the books of the Bible and just start and just work that way. Something that to us seems so simple, but yet it's extremely profound. Which leads me to the fourth thought that I have, and that's this. The simplicity of the gospel is not seen in America. The simplicity of Christianity is seen outside our borders. We have made Christianity very difficult. We are very caught up in gossip. We are very caught up in man-centeredness. I am of Paul, I am of Paulus, I am of Christ. That is today. I am of John MacArthur, I am of John Piper, I of and on it goes. We have become very man-centered. So the Church of Jesus Christ is all about, have you heard Him preach? Have you listened to His message? Rather than, I wonder if I can minister to somebody over here, you know, that doesn't even know Jesus. Christianity for us today is something that goes far beyond what America has made it. What we have turned Christianity into, it has morphed into a Western religion. And the Western religion is a religion that talks about Jesus but is empty of power. It's a religion that hires pastors to do the work of the ministry when Ephesians 4 says the people are to do it. Can you imagine 20 house churches? Tonight I'm going to give you a testimony of Nicholas, the man who made the most profound impact in my life. This man pastors 17 churches. And I would say to us today that, you know, it's the people who are doing the ministry. It is the people who are reaching out and ministering to pagans and people who are without Jesus, who are hungry and thirsting for righteousness. And so they are doing the work. And so that's why the house church movement is growing. They are doing it without pastors. Now, eventually, that's going to be the weakness of the church because they're going to be susceptible to things. But what is, by illustration, that is happening now is we're very into things in America. We're very into education. We're very into accreditation. We're very interested to big name schools and big name things. All they're asking is just, I need a little bit of Bible training. Can somebody tell me how the Bible fits together? That's all I want to know, because I'm going to go to village places where people are illiterate, where people don't understand, where people are searching for something, they don't know what it is, and they're not searching for Western Christianity. What they're searching for is Jesus Christ. They just don't know. I mean, it's a crime to speak of Jesus in this incredible land to people who are under 18 years of age. So two thoughts have been going through my mind. And here are the two thoughts. These are the two questions. What does it mean to be a Christian? And the second question that is connected to that is, what does it mean to look like Christ? What does it mean to be a Christian? And then what does it mean to look like that? To look like Jesus. And whatever our answer is, it works here and it works there. So let me take a couple of minutes with you in Galatians 4. Take your Bible and turn to Galatians 4. These two questions are related to one another. These two questions, what it means to be a Christian, not to be in a church on Sunday morning in Virginia Beach, but what it means to be a Christian, and number two, what it means to look like Jesus, are connected. For instance, if I were to hold in my hand an apple, in this apple would be a core, there would be seed, there would be pulp, and there would be peeling, all four of those. All four are distinguishable parts, but all four are inseparable. Distinguishable, but inseparable. That is exactly these two questions. What does it mean to be a Christian, and what does it mean to look like one? Those two are inseparable, though distinguishable. And it's interesting to me that in Galatians in chapter 4, these couple of verses have really been going over and over my mind. In fact, I've preached several times while I was away preaching in these churches. I preached at least twice on this passage here because this is what's been capturing my thinking. Verse 4, but when the fullness of the time has come, God sent forth His Son. That word sent forth means God dispatched. God sent His Son. God gave His Son a divine mission. This divine mission was given exclusively to Jesus. So when you read verse 4, God waits until the exact time frame. History up to this point, if Abraham is 2100 BC, who knows? Short age, longer of the world, it doesn't matter to me where you actually place it, but for thousands of years, things have gone on, and God waits till this time to dispatch with a divine commission his son. God sent forth. That is a term, ex apostello, that is a term of divine commission. Now, what does that mean? It means two things in this verse. God dispatched his son, number one, made out of woman. Now, here's the first thing it means. Now, just think of this. That Spirit Jesus becomes flesh Jesus. Now, just think of this. Spirit Jesus becomes flesh Jesus. This is what the divine commission means. It means a change of status to the one who is glorious and exalted, to the one who is made a doulos. Not just born out of woman, as we see here, but as I've preached to you in the past from the book here, that he was made a slave. That's the book of Philippians. Made a slave. He was lower than the lowest of the average man. So this is what it means. God dispatched his divine, perfect, glorious Spirit Son with a divine commission. And that divine commission meant, number one, he has to become flesh Jesus. Spirit Jesus, now flesh Jesus. He is the perfect God-man. The second thing it means, according to this verse, is that he was born under the law. What that means is this. Spirit Jesus becomes flesh Jesus. Flesh Jesus is going to be subject to the unbending, flawless, exacting law. Measure his life by the measurement in which no one for 1,400 years since Moses, for 1,400 years, had ever lived up to it. God is dispatching Spirit Jesus to become flesh. And flesh Jesus will be subject to this exacting, unbending rule of government called the law of Moses. And not one single human being has ever matched up with, not even come close. That's what this verse is saying. But the amazing thing in verse number 5, in the Greek text, a purpose clause. In fact, there are two purpose clauses in verse 5. In order that he might redeem those that are under the law. That's everybody. That he might redeem. That word redeem is an interesting term found two times in the New Testament in relationship to atonement. Both of them in Galatians. Galatians 3:13 is the other one. Christ has redeemed us, 3:13, from the curse of the law, having become a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is everyone that hangs on a tree. The word redeemed is the word that means to buy completely, to pay the price completely, to deliver completely from. It is a picture that we might have today of slavery, which would have been much worse in that century than it was here, is just an atrocity to us here. But it was much worse. I mean, there's no such thing as some kind of protection of humanity. And these slaves were nothing but property and had no name except what their master gave them, and no life except what their master allowed them, and no time except what the master gave to them. So Jesus comes to pay the full penalty for full deliverance. And if you look at verse number 7 here, it tells you the most incredible result of that is so that we are no longer slaves, but so that we become sons. And this is what's so amazing in verse number 5. Not only did Jesus come to redeem, to pay a full price, flesh Jesus pays the full price under the law, which is death, 3:13.
But flesh Jesus also goes through this in order that we might become full adult sons. That's what adoption means. Full adult sons. In other words, the moment someone is saved, the moment someone becomes a believer in Jesus Christ, you have all the keys to the house and to the car spiritually. When your little baby came home, and it was a wonderful, you know, 7-pound tax exemption, and you brought this little baby home, and you set that little baby down, you didn't lecture that baby and say, okay, now son, your mom took 9 months to bring you into this world. You owe her. Here's the newspaper. Here's the keys to the car. Get a job. No. But that's what we aphasion means. It means the moment someone is saved, they get all the keys to the entire house, to all the closets, to the car, to everything spiritually. That's what it says in Ephesians 1:3. He has blessed us with every spiritual blessing. Every person who is saved gets every spiritual blessing. So here you are as a new babe in Christ with every spiritual blessing. How do you live? Because you've never tried the key to the car. You don't know how to drive. Your life has been pagan. So that's the importance of teaching. And so you put this into China language, and you see 100 million people who are in these little tiny pockets of fellowship around this mega nation. And they don't know how to put the key into the ignition. Just like you. I mean, somebody had to come and say, you know what it's like to drive stick shift? You know what that's like? You know, the manual? And you get in and you start it and you never really thought about the clutch before, but now all of a sudden the clutch really becomes a very important ingredient to you. And how you put it in first and then how you put it in reverse and how you come up to stop and then how you take off. And so, you know, you go through all of these things so that you're able to drive the car. And this is how it is spiritually. Spiritually, you have this book of 66 books. Each of them has a particular theme and direction. And so now you've got to know, okay, where do I start? Where do I go? I mean, how does it fit? So here Jesus comes to redeem, to buy out, so that everyone is going to be redeemed and the full penalty is paid, and then everyone now is in a full adult son. Everybody can vote. Everybody's of age spiritually. And so here we are. Now what do we do with all of these spiritual blessings? How do we put it together? See, what does it mean to be a Christian? What it means is to understand that Spirit Jesus became flesh Jesus for you, to buy you out, to redeem you out of the slave market of sin in which you found yourself shackled. And not only did he do that, but he now makes you his son, a full adult son. That's why it says in verse number 7, just skip down to verse 7 again, if you're the end of the verse, if you are a full adult son, that means you're an heir of God. I mean, that little baby that you bring home physically, that has no idea what it's an heir to. Some of you don't know what you're an heir to either. But this baby has no idea what he's an heir to. He didn't choose the home. So this is God's choice. And so God is saying, I am making you not just, I'm releasing you and freeing you from prison of sin, but I'm also going to make you my son. And you become an heir. So when I ask the question, what does it really mean to become a Christian? What it means to become a Christian is that Jesus has bought you. And Jesus has made you a full adult son so that you are an heir to all that God has. How much does God have? He has it all. What does it mean to become a Christian? And see, people are still way over here piddling around with what can I drink and what can I watch and what can I wear and where can I go? That's America. We have nothing else to do. I mean, we got translations. I got 26 translations, the Bible. I got commentaries. I mean, what else can I really argue about except what can I drink and where can I go and what should I wear? I mean, that's our Christianity. So our Christianity is a lot different. Do you know, I was in one church that had four services, and this one church had as many people there Sunday night as they do Sunday morning. They sing forever. 45 minutes. It's okay. I enjoyed it, what I could understand of it. You see, the Christianity that we're talking about is a Christianity that you walk into the room and they get there 10 minutes early so they can turn on the air conditioner. By the way, you know what it's like in the islands over there. And they have an air conditioner that goes against the wall. And they turn that little thing on, and then they go over to the other side and they have to turn that little one on over there. And it's a 30-foot high ceiling, and it's about as long as this here and a little bit narrow. And I'm thinking, those two things are going to do. And they turn it on 10 minutes before the service. They don't have the money to have all the other things. And they basically probably do it for us. And when I look at what is Christianity, Christianity is boiled down in Galatians chapter 4. It's boiled down to Jesus. He becomes flesh. And because of flesh, he lives under the law. He takes the entire law upon himself, does it perfectly, pays the penalty under the law, and because he is God, pays that penalty, rises from the dead. So now we have an infinite sacrifice. And this infinite sacrifice is not just a sacrifice for sin, but also bestowing upon us full adult sonship. That's what it means to be a Christian. But there's still one more thing. And this is fantastic. Look at verse 6. And because you are sons, God, same word as verse 4, sent forth. God dispatched Spirit. Okay? In verse number 4, God dispatched Spirit Jesus to become flesh Jesus. But now, in verse number 6, because you are newborns and now you are full adult sons, God dispatched, exagorazo, same term, God dispatched the Spirit of His Son. And since He's Spirit, you know, He can be everywhere in all of His essence at one time. Omnipresent. And He goes into your hearts. And this is what He is doing in your hearts. He is crying out through you after the Father. Now just stop and think about this. Before, I was living a pagan life. I was shackled to sin. Romans 6, I was a slave to sin. Now, what is Christianity? Christianity is Spirit Jesus becoming flesh Jesus. And flesh Jesus is now going to redeem us, buy us out of the slave market of sin through His perfect life and through His substitutionary sacrificial death and through His resurrection. And when I believe in Jesus to be God's way, then I become a full adult son. I'm fully redeemed. And then guess what? I get the Spirit on the inside. And the Spirit comes on the inside, and the Spirit now is on inside me, and it's going this: Father. You know, you take a little child that can just barely talk. And don't you love it when you hear them say mama or daddy? And you walk into a room and that child now has been with you for so many months. maybe a year, maybe a little older than that. And so you come into it, and the room is full of people, but that little child is looking up, and is looking for mama and looking for daddy. And you know, you can say everything you want to say, and you can bend down and you can pick up that little baby and you can just cuddle up on that little baby and tell how sweet they are and lovable they are, and all of a sudden that face just screws up and starts to cry right in your face. You're trying to be kind and gracious and helpful, but all of a sudden, mama's face appears, daddy's face appears, and all of a sudden those arms just go out. That is exactly what is happening here. See, the Spirit inside is recreating us. So now we're going, our father before was Satan. You were of your father, the devil. He was a liar and a murderer from the beginning, John 8:44. Now your father, who has birthed you, your father is God. And so the Spirit on the inside is empowering you to turn from this daddy to this one. So when I ask the question, what does it mean to become a Christian? What it means is so heavy laden with theology, but it is so simple. That God dispatches the Son to accomplish the work. And then, when there's belief, then God dispatches the Spirit, and He's inside of you, and He's causing you to go hard after your true daddy. Your Father, Abba, Father. So now, and I'm almost done here because the rest of my message is going to be for tonight. I want you to flip the page with me to Galatians in chapter 5. In Galatians 5, the Apostle Paul says, now here, if you're really a true believer, verse 16a, this is what I want you to do. I want you to walk by government of the dispatched Spirit. That's what it means when it says walk in the Spirit. He is saying, you now have a Spirit dispatched directly from God. He is in your heart. And now I want you to walk your daily grind of life. It's metaphorical language, your daily grind of life, everything that happens in your life, I want you to walk, to live your life underneath the government of the Spirit that I dispatched to you when you were saved. The Spirit that on the inside looks at me as your Father and says, Father, I'm going hard after you. I have in my library, and I got it down last night, was a little book, and that book is called Romans for the Family Hour. Do you remember that, Mom and Dad? Romans for the Family Hour. It's written in 1959, okay? 9/10 of you weren't even born then, okay, right? 1959. By Ken Taylor. And Ken Taylor wrote this, and my parents got it, and so when we were little kids, what I remember is from all of our family hours together was this little booklet that my mom and dad took us through. It's about almost, I don't know, about that thick, maybe, you know, I don't know, 150, 200 pages. And it takes excerpts from the book of Romans, just a few verses, and then there's a story that kind of highlights for children how this fits. And there's one that really struck me. Oh, there's several that struck me. One really struck me was there's this woman who marries this man, and the relationship after the honeymoon turns extremely sour. After the honeymoon, they come back, and the husband looks at her, and he hands her a list. Do you remember this? He hands her a list. He says, okay, now, I want you to do these 17 things that I have here on this list. You want to be a good wife to me? Here it is. Tears. But the bad part is, he wasn't teasing. He really meant this. As providence would have it, he dies early. She She meets a wonderful man. They get married. Have a great relationship. Years later, I love the way Ken Taylor writes, years later, she's up in the attic, and she's going, he uses the word rummaging. You know what rummaging is? I don't know. That's an old word. Rummaging. You're just going directionless. You know, some of you do this every Saturday morning when you're looking for these little things that people have, garage sales, rummaging. That's what you're doing. Just, wow. Get out of their way. Here they come. That's not in my message yet. She's up there rummaging. And she opens up these, and then she opens up this one, and she reaches in, and she pulls out a tattered list. And she looks at this list of these things that her first husband had given to her, tears coming down her face. Not only, as Ken Taylor writes, not only is she doing those things, but she's doing so much more because of the love she has. And see, this is where our Christianity gets all mixed up. It doesn't say walk by government of your list. Because most of us define our Christianity by what we don't do or what we can do. Or what I am doing. That's how we define our Christianity. Surely, look at what I'm doing. I work in Awana. I'm a Sunday school teacher. Look at me. I'm teaching Bible Institute. I teach in the seminary. I'm a secretary. I'm a pastor. You see, we got our list, and we may not have written it down, but our list is this. I know I'm a good Christian because I don't do this, and I don't do that, and I don't do this, and I do this, and I do this, and I do this. So we walk by government of our mental list. And when people don't measure up to our mental list, then all of a sudden we look over and we say, hey, there's really something wrong with them. I mean, I used to do that years ago, but I no longer do that now. You see, and what has happened in our Christianity is it's no longer spirit-driven, it's list-driven. It's personality-driven. It's driven by things so that most kids grow up in Christian homes, and it's all about the list. Where is the spirit in this? Where is the motivating power in a life that takes a mom and dad and so transforms them that their marriage looks like Jesus in the church, and the kids go, wow, something has happened here. You see, the list is great for little children. We walk outside and we say, now, honey, this is the driveway. You can't walk there. This is the street. You can't walk there. This is the neighborhood. You can't walk there. So we gave them the list. You can play in here, and mommy and daddy will be very happy. You go outside here, and you're going to get whacked. We got the list. Now, when you sit down at the table, here's the list, okay? We always pray before we eat. And then you always say this, and you always, so we got all these. You see, now, men and women, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with this. I'm just saying that that's for babies. So that in the Christian world, when you have your list, it is because you don't understand what it means to walk in maturity. It's all about your list. And you've been walking with God for 30 years, but you live by your list. You would have no idea what it means to live by government of the Spirit. You have no idea what it means to live in an orbit of grace. We get a little shaky when we talk about that. But the same power that sent Spirit Jesus to become flesh Jesus.